So, welcome again, everyone. Tonight, I'm going to talk about some stories from the Buddha's life and some wisdom that we can glean from those. And this is a little bit of a companion talk to a talk I gave last year on our own personal stories. This is about more of the archetypal stories of the Buddha. And I guess I'll frame it in terms of this notion of deep stories. This is a term coined by a sociologist, Arlie Hochschild. And she talks about this deep story, or some people call it a source story, being a metaphor or an image or a story that describes some aspect, some dimension of how we see reality. And it's beneath all of our mind's daily stories. Sometimes it can be a collective story. In any case, whether they're collective or personal, these kinds of more archetypal stories can be vitally important to our own health and even how we see the meaning of life. Much of my work as a hospital chaplain is listening to a person's story and underneath their daily life stories for their deep story. It's such a vital role that a palliative care chaplain, Chaplain Rebecca Schmidt, refers to herself as a story catcher, like a dream catcher, right? Story catcher. And our minds, all of us, our minds are story catchers in a certain kind of way. Unfortunately, often it's a little bit more like we're getting caught by our stories rather than gleaning the wisdom from them. And healing through stories, reframing stories, can help people come to terms, cope, heal, let go into change, even let go into death with peace, equanimity. Now, often, as you guys know, the emphasis in meditation circles, Buddhist meditation circles, is for good reason on finding space from or disidentifying with stories. And there's a big role for that. And as many of you have no doubt discovered, there's also a big role for noticing how stories influence us. So the invitation for the next little while is to notice how these more mythic stories of the Buddha touch you or maybe resonate with parts of your life. So the Buddha had his own stories, and many of them you're probably familiar with, but I'll just sort of talk through a little bit. When he was born, his mother was on the way from the castle where she and the Buddha's father lived to follow an ancient tradition in their culture of going back to her family of origin to give birth. But she didn't make it the whole way. She gave birth to him on the bank of a riverbank in a park. And the story goes that a seer, came by shortly after his birth and prophesied that he would be either a great leader of people or a great spiritual teacher. So either a king or a spiritual teacher. And unfortunately, shortly around the time of that prophecy, within days of the Buddha's birth, his mother sickened and died. And childbirth was a very dangerous activity for much of humanity's history. So his father raised him, and his stepmother, his mom's sister, married his father. And they protected him and gave him every luxury. They didn't want any reason for him to question his role as heir to the kingdom, to question his role as a leader of people. But perhaps touched by the loss of his mother before he could even remember her, or perhaps just out of curiosity of a young man, he escaped the palace grounds on several occasions, his very, very cloistered upbringing, and with a friend who was a charioteer there, got out into the villages, into the city. And there he saw what are known as the four heavenly messengers, the four great messengers, a sick person, an old person, a corpse, and a sage. And his encounters with the suffering old age, sickness, death, and the inspiration of another way really inspired him to start his practice, inspired him to leave his life of luxury, privilege. Now, I'll just pause here for a moment to just ask, like, how many of us entered the spiritual path, meditation, due to some encounter with this or another kind of suffering, ours or someone else's? And it's a very common doorway in, the dukkha doorway, they call it. So as a young man in the prime of life, he left the castle, snuck out at night, and went on this long spiritual quest of many years, and went through phases of a number of different teachers, excelled in them, like concentration states and all these esoteric practices, but they weren't leading to the end of that suffering. So he would move on. And he went through one stage of his practice, sort of towards the end of his journey towards awakening, where he was practicing austerities, being very hard on himself. And the austerities were very common practices in that day. So they would be things like staying awake for long, long periods of time and denying oneself food or drink or sleep. And there is a point that is recorded in the ancient discourses where he talked about being so thin that if he touched his belly, he could feel his backbone. So it's that kind of extreme self-denial. He was pushing too hard. And while most of us have probably not done that, like speaking for myself and many students I've talked to, it's easy to push too hard, to punish ourselves internally, to try to get somewhere. And it might work in the short term, but it often doesn't work in the long term. Certainly doesn't have beneficial side effects. It didn't for the Buddha. He collapsed one day by the side of the road and was lying there, perhaps mistaken for dead by a lot of people going by. But a young woman, a maiden, it said, carrying her rice gruel for the day, encountered him and moved by kindness, moved by compassion, she stopped and cradled his head and fed him gently. This rice gruel. And that kindness, that was the moment where his practice began to turn. He was nourished, physically saved from starvation, but also receiving this nourishment, this goodness, this human compassion and contact. He began to practice again, and then a memory emerged. It was a memory of being like around 7 years old, maybe, and sitting at the side of his father's fields under the shade of a rose apple tree and watching his father's team work the fields, just kind of from a distance. And it's a warm day, comfortable in the shade. And he just falls into this beautiful, kind of natural, stable, meditative state. Very pleasurable. And that was when he recognized that pleasure was not to be feared, especially the spiritual pleasures of meditation, and began allowing a sense of joy and wholesome pleasure into his practice in a different way, a natural way. And his practice progressed. So, not that much longer came the night of his awakening. And he was up all night sitting, and the story goes that Mara, the sort of incarnate force of life-denying or evil in ancient Buddhism, would came to him. And Mara literally in Pali means death, just to give you an idea. So it's kind of like an archetypal force, archetypal being. And this kind of life-denying energy brings every force to bear to try to prevent awakening. brings sensual desire and ill will and horrific visions of all kinds. And none of it moves the Buddha. The Buddha's practice is just solid, right? Just solid. And then finally, Mara taunts the Buddha with doubt, the most difficult hindrance of all. Who are you? Who are you to awaken? And the Buddha simply puts his hand down and touches the earth. The earth is my witness. And at that point, it's said that the earth shook. And all of the kind of arrows of Mara's army of the ill will and horrific visions and desires sort of convert to flowers. And the Buddha is there alone. Mara is gone. The problems are gone. And the awakening happens. So this is kind of a mythic story, you can tell, right, from the images and that. There's something so beautiful that it evokes. There's sort of two themes here. First, the power of being grounded in our own seat, our own place in the world, own place on this earth. And the second is the power of seeing through the barbs and the arrows of self-criticism or imagined problems or even difficult history, and that being converted by wisdom, by clear seeing, into fuel for the practice. Flowers. So the last little anecdote of this awakening story is it said that after his awakening, the Buddha sat staring at the Bodhi tree that sheltered him for 7 days in gratitude. So just love. Offering a tree, offering your surroundings, the conditions that support us, that kind of gratitude. The Buddha also inspired countless others then and now to change life paths, to change their stories, how they related to internal experience for the better. It said he was awakened around the time he was 40. And what the historians have been able to piece together is he spent the next 40 years wandering around on foot, what is now North India and Southern Nepal, teaching, moved by compassion, and a sense inspired by someone who convinced him to teach, that there would be people that would benefit. So one way he inspired this countless others is this sort of archetypal distillation I'll give in the discourses. People would abandon the killing of living beings with weapons laid aside, conscientious, merciful, abiding, compassionate to all living beings. That's described as the impulse that brought people onto the path to ordain as a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni, a monk or a nun, to give over their lives to the practice and to non-harming. And then the second sort of inspiration was much broader, actually. Many, many lay people who never ordained, never followed the Buddha as mendicants, would convert and follow his teachings. And the teaching that they followed was the fundamental ethics kind of that branch out from that non-harming, which is not stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, not lying or having malicious speech, and basically becoming a source of non-harming in the world as best they can. Can we imagine the difference in our world if everyone simply committed to one of these? One, not all five. Make a big difference, right? So there's a particularly powerful story of the Buddha changing someone else's life trajectory in this way. And I'll give a little bit of the backstory. This is the story of a man named Ahimsa, very talented, trusting student. He was a very talented young man, boy, and his parents scraped together the best they could. They weren't wealthy, but they scraped together to send him to one of the best schools in the area. It was like a boarding school, sent him away. And some reputable teacher, and he's so quick and so sincere and so affable that he quickly becomes a favorite of the teacher. And this teacher is quite prominent. There's a little bit of a scene there, right? And unfortunately, with his sincerity and his genuineness, and I guess he was good looking as well as smart, like he became the envy of a lot of the other students at the school. Everyone was kind of jockeying for position, wanting to be close to this teacher. So some of these other students got together after trying to like dislodge him from his favorite spot. And they got together to coordinate sort of a fake news campaign to the teacher. So individually they complained about him, but the teacher wasn't listening. He and Ahimsa were tight. So what they did was coordinate these different sort of malicious stories, rumors that would then seem to emerge from different parts of the school about this young man. And the first time the teacher heard something, he didn't believe it. And the second time he didn't believe it, but the fifth, 10th, 12th, 20th time, the teacher finally turned and thought that Ahimsa was plotting against him. He did something that I find appalling. He gives Ahimsa this grotesque assignment that he doesn't actually expect him to fulfill, but he just wants to get him out. He wants to drive him away. And he tells him that in order to embark on the next phase of his training, he has to kill at least, I can't remember if it was 100 or 1,000 people, 1,000 people, and make a mala, a necklace of each of their fingers. One finger from each person, and bring it back to the teacher before he will be allowed to be initiated to the next level. And at first, Ahimsa resists, but the teacher persuades him he must go. He must go. He just wanted to get him out of there, I think. And Ahimsa set his mind on this and became a mass murderer known by the name of Angulimala. Angulimala, garland of fingers. He was feared for good reason. He was avoided. And some years went by, and Angulimala has killed many, many people and sort of is a force in the kingdom. Like the king wants to pull together armies to try to get this murderer under control. And the Buddha happens to stop by the place where they're gathering forces to kind of track this murderer down. And they try to prevent the Buddha from walking into the region where Angulimala is. And the Buddha refuses to change his course and starts walking through this forest alone without his monks. And Angulimala starts to chase him. Apparently, he's one finger away from being finished. And Buddha is going to be it, right? So he starts running after him. The Buddha just continues to walk slowly, but somehow Angulimala can't catch up. And he keeps running, and Buddha keeps walking. And eventually, Angulimala becomes frustrated and yells, "Stop, monk, stop." And the Buddha stops and he turns around. And he says, "Angulimala, I have stopped. Now it's your turn to stop." And this apparently cuts through the delusion this man has been experiencing. And he walks up to the Buddha and he drops down at his feet, realizes what he's been doing. And I don't know exactly what he said, but there was some kind of motion of remorse, giving over. And he asks to be ordained in the Buddhist monks and into the monkhood. His change of heart was like this, right? And the Buddha accepts. And so Angulimala enters this order of monks, and he is hated, right? They are going from village to village to get food. And the villagers know who he is. And they pelt him with fruit or pelt him with rocks. But he just bears it. Before he even gets to the point of being recognized by the villagers, though, the king of the realm goes to the Buddha explaining that they haven't been able to find Angulimala. And Angulimala, now Ahimsa again, is sitting next to the Buddha, head shaved, robes, the whole thing. And the Buddha reintroduces him. And the king is terrified, but he explains. And Ahimsa agrees. He's given up a life of crime. This conversion, this kind of rebirth, if you will, into the Dharma was so powerful that it was noticeable to anyone who got close to him. He just apparently embodied a certain kind of peace and compassion. You can only imagine what he had to work through in meditation. So much so that in the course of his life, he encountered a pregnant woman, Angulimala did, as a monk. This pregnant woman's having difficult childbirth. I guess he was in his rounds or whatever, begging. And he could tell she was going to die if he didn't get help. So he ran back to the Buddha. He's like, we have to help this woman. And the Buddha says, here's what you do. You go to her and you say, by the truth of these words that I have never harmed another living being, may your childbirth be easeful. Angulimala was like, I can't say that. Notice, you know, that 99 people back there. And the Buddha says, it's by the truth of these words, you have never harmed a human being since you were born into the Dharma. And so he goes and says that to her. And in this myth, she gives birth without being harmed. So this man's story changed twice, right? From a promising young man, talented young student to mass murderer, and then again from murderer to very compassionate, very caring monk. I wasn't able to listen to last week's presentation. I think it was last week when Grip came, is that right? Guiding Rage into Power. But I think of some of those men and how they've managed to change their lives in the process of that practice, process of working in that program. And it's truly extraordinary. This shifting of the suffering, not just of the suffering that is inflicted upon us, as most people who hurt others have been hurt in some way, but also the transformation of the suffering of having caused harm can lead to a very, very deep kind of shift, turning point. So, Angulimala evolved, developed, grew. And people like, figures like him in the ancient stories, and people like some of the folks from graduated from the GRIP program inspire me, right? They're inspiring to think about what's possible with that kind of fierce compassion and dedication to honesty and practice. One more story. This is of someone who was bereaved, not because someone she loved was murdered, but she, after many years of trying, this woman, Kisika Tomi, gave birth to a son. And young in his life, early in his life, he died. And she was just absolutely distraught. And something in her kind of snapped. And she went carrying him around, asking anyone to help heal him, to wake him up, to snap him out of being dead, basically, which she wasn't able to see. And finally, the Buddha came through town and people sent her to him. And instead of arguing with her the way everyone else had, no, he's gone. You can't bring him back. He said, here's what you do. Go from house to house in this village and gather me a mustard seed from every house where there's no one who's ever died. Any house not tainted, not touched by death. And so she does. She goes from house to house. And what she discovered was, in dialogue with each of these other houses, households, that every single person, every single family had lost someone, was touched by death. And at the end of her journey, she comes back to the Buddha and she finally understands. She's finally able, because of this communal sharing of loss, to take in the grief and to recognize that her son is gone and to let him go. The universality of death can be connection, source of compassion and understanding. So these are just some of the stories from the Buddha's life about him, and just a couple of the tiny few people fortunate enough to know him compared to the many touched by his stories now. But I wanted to go over some of them because his example caused many people in his time, all the way from then through the centuries to our time, to share their story, to change their story to one of compassion, to one of ethical conduct, and to various degrees of awakening. So those are my thoughts.